So now we're going to move on. We're going to talk about peripheral nervous system drugs. I've got some new slides special for you guys, and these are some things that students often get confused or just forget about. Some of the conversations I had with some seniors prompted me to put this in because they're like, we don't know what those things are. And I'm like, yeah, well, you learned about it the first week of nursing school. I did? Yeah. And so, okay, so I'm going to put it on a slide that's like a summary. So, sympathetic and adrenergic mean the same thing, kind of. Adrenergic refers to the receptor and the effect. And the sympathetic system is the system that produces those adrenergic effects. If you're increasing sympathetic response, the drug is called a sympathomimetic, coming from mimic. If it's a sympatholytic, sympatholysis, you're breaking or reducing the amount of sympathetic system or sympathetic response. Same thing happens with the parasympathetic. That's called cholinergic, which refers to the receptors. The exception there, of course, is sweat glands. I feel like I'm talking about nothing but sweat. Anticholinergic and antimuscarinic and sympatholytic, parasympatholytic, are all synonyms. Now, technically, the term anticholinergic also includes the nicotinic N nicotinic M as well. But in practice, when people talk about anticholinergic drugs, 99% of the time, they're talking about antimuscarinic drugs. And then we have paralytics, which block nicotinic M receptors or neuromuscular junctions. All right, so let's talk about parasympathetic drugs in particular. These are the classes of cholinergic drugs. We are not going to learn all of these. We're only going to learn muscarinic antagonists, neuromuscular blockers, and cholinesterase inhibitors. How does that sound? So the rest of it's just to show you how nice I am. All right, so here we have our superhero. And, let's see, she's too tall. So I'm going to have to draw my own alien. All right, so okay, so here is our alien. And we're going to give our alien some eyes. And what we're talking about right now is muscarinic receptors. So where do muscarinic receptors live in the body? Well, the first place is, I already drew them, in the eyes. So in the eyes, and for whatever reason, I don't know why, but we're going to put stimulate on the right side and block on the left side. So when you stimulate muscarinic receptors, what effect are you going to get? You're going to get constriction of the ciliary muscle. That's going to cause two things. It's going to focus the eye, but it's also going to result in the pupil becoming smaller. If the pupils become very, very small, that is known as meiosis. Meiosis also occurs with some other drugs, particularly opioid drugs. So the classic thing is you have a heroin addict who's got these tiny little pinprick pupils, so they wear sunglasses all the time. But that makes it harder for them to see because everything is already dark because their pupils are constricted. Now they put on sunglasses and they kind of bump around like they're half blind. So a person who's got meiosis needs a brighter environment, not a darker environment. They also have a nose and a mouth. And in all three of these places, we're going to have increased secretion. So, more tears, more mucus in the nose, and more saliva. Then we have an airway, a trachea. And here we're going to have constriction of the bronchi. And we're also going to have increased sputum. Sputum is just one of those lovely descriptive terms. You know, it's just lovely. So, increased sputum and increased constriction. Those things can make it harder for a person to breathe, especially if they have lung problems to begin with. Next, we have the heart. And in the heart, when you stimulate the muscarinic receptors, you're going to slow the heart rate. Now, we got to talk about a vocabulary term real quick-like, and that is tropic. So anytime you see the word tropic, a drug with tropic in it, it means it affects. So a neurotropic affects neurons. A psychotropic affects psychiatric. And chronotropic affects heart rate. So if you think of chronological having to do with time, chronotropic affects speed of the heart. If it makes it go down, that's called negative chronotropic. And if it makes it go heart rate go up, that would be called positive chronotropic. All right. Then we have your stomach and intestines. And that is going to cause two things. One is increased GI secretions. So gastric juices and other digestive juices. And it's also going to increase peristalsis. Now, what would happen if you had too much GI stimulation by parasympathetic? By muscarinic receptors. What would happen? Okay, you might have diarrhea. You have too much liquid going in there. And what else? What might those muscles do as they peristalse? They do contract, but what symptom might occur? Cramping. So patients can have GI spasms, and they can have cramping as a result of too much parasympathetic stimulation. Sometimes some people just have that naturally. And then other times it's induced by a drug. And then the last thing that we're going to care about anyway is the bladder. And in the bladder you're going to have, what's the muscle that is responsible for contraction of the bladder? Starts with a D. The detrusor muscle. And when that contracts, that causes what reflex? The micturition reflex. So that is associated with increased micturition, or the urge to go to the bathroom. All right, so in terms of stimulation, when you stimulate the muscarinic receptors, whether it's naturally or whether it's with a drug, you're going to end up with these things occurring. Now, your homework is to draw your own alien and draw in the organs and label what happens when you stimulate those receptors. If you skip this step, if you skip your homework, it's going to be that much harder on the test. I just really can't emphasize enough how important it is to draw the little guy or girl, put the little organs in there, and say what happens when you stimulate those receptors. Or, when you come to the other side, what happens when you block those receptors. This pen isn't quite dark enough. Let's try this one. Not that much better. So, when we block it. Now, if we start at the eye, what happens when you block muscarinic? You're going to dilate the eye. So instead of constriction, it's going to be dilate. And when an eye is dilated too much, what happens? Well, first of all, everything looks really bright, and it's blurry up close. How many of you ever had your eyes dilated? and everything's really bright and it's really blurry. Now, as your vision comes back, you begin to notice you can see far away more clearly than you can up close. Why is that? Nope. To focus up close, what do you have to do? You have to constrict. And so the ability to constrict a little bit is enough to focus out there, but you don't quite have the ability to focus up close yet as the drug wears off. So that's what happens with mydriasis. The next thing, all of these little glands, you end up with dryness. Dryness of the mouth, nose, and eyes. And now, even though it's not under the control of the parasympathetic system, I should also mention sweat. So if you stimulate muscarinic receptors with a drug, you're also going to get more sweat. And if you block them with a drug, you're going to inhibit sweat, even though it's not parasympathetic. In the bronchi, what are we going to get? Decreased sputum and bronchodilation, so it's easier to breathe. Does that sound useful? Do you think it might be useful to have a drug that can reduce the amount of sputum and make it easier to breathe because your airway is bigger? Yeah. What do you think we could use a drug that does that for? Okay, bronchitis, sure. Asthma and chronic bronchitis are the main ones. Then in the heart, we're going to increase heart rate. So what effect would that be considered in terms of tropic or tropic? Positive chronotropic effect. In the GI tract, we are going to relax the GI tract and have fewer or less secretion. So that can be used for a patient who is experiencing GI cramping or abdominal cramping. And one of the uses for that drug is in patients who have irritable bowel syndrome, where they've got a lot of cramping. And then the last one is in the bladder, it is going to prevent micturition. Now, in terms of drugs, there's a saying that all drugs are poison. The magic is in the dose. So even though you can prevent micturition as a therapeutic goal, who would you want to use that in? What kind of person would want to not pee? An elderly person who has incontinence. So if you have a patient with incontinence, you could potentially treat the incontinence with an anticholinergic drug, a drug that blocks choline receptors. The problem is, you could also cause, as an adverse effect, urinary retention, where they can't go to the bathroom enough. And what is the danger of urinary retention? Well, increased risk for infection is one. And if it's severe enough, it can actually lead to acute renal failure because you back the urine up all the way to the kidney. So there's some dangers to doing it. So you can have that as a goal, reduce the amount of urine. But if you do it too much, you can end up toxic with some problems with urinary retention. So in all of these cases, there's a therapeutic goal, but if you push it too much, it might be a problem. Now, in terms of the heart rate, if we raise the heart rate too much, what adverse effect would that be? What's it called when your heart rate goes too fast? Tachycardia. So if we want to raise a person's heart rate, we can do it. But if we raise it too much, what can happen? You just said it 3 seconds ago. Tachycardia. Now, what happens if you're wanting to treat a patient's urinary incontinence with an anticholinergic? Could you affect their heart too? So, you're treating this, but you get this adverse effect. That can happen as well. So, with anticholinergic drugs, any of these things could happen. The question is, what are we trying to treat? And then the other is, would most likely be adverse effects if they happen. Does that make sense? So you give a patient who's got incontinence an anticholinergic, and as an adverse effect, they could have constipation, they could have tachycardia. This is usually not really considered an adverse effect no matter what happens. They could have dry mouth, dry eyes, dry skin, and they could have mydriasis. Does that make sense? You've got a patient who's got low heart rate, you're trying to raise it. They could have urinary retention, they could have constipation, they could have dry mouth, dry eyes, dry nose, and they could have mydriasis. Does that make sense? Okay. So, now you know the adverse effects of anticholinergic drugs. It doesn't matter which anticholinergic drug it is, they all have the same adverse effects, at least potential adverse effects. The only real question now is, which drug is used for which thing? So you ready for that? The first drug on our list is atropine. And atropine can be used for all of these things, however it's not. In reality, it's really going to just be used for two things. The first one is heart rate. We can use it to raise the patient's heart rate. Now, there's only really two times we want to do that. One is before surgery. Some of the drugs we use for anesthesia can lower the heart rate. So sometimes you actually give those drugs on the hospital floor before they go to surgery. So you give a drug to the patient, you give the patient a drug that could potentially lower the heart rate, and that might stop, and that would be bad because the patient would be technically dead. So we want to keep the patient alive, so you give them a drug, atropine, to keep the heart rate high. So pre-anesthesia is one time. The other is when a patient's heart rate is too low. What's the fancy word for too low? Bradycardia. Now, you guys have all had at least one class of health assessment, and you've taken each other's heart rates, right? What's normal heart rate for an adult? 60 to 100. You guys are backwards from me. How many of you in here had a heart rate lower than 60? Nobody? Usually in a room this full of young women tend to be small in stature, there's usually a few people who have heart rates of 55, 58. Does that mean they have bradycardia and we should treat them with atropine? No? Why not? Because it's normal for them. So, when it comes to treating patients, there's two essential rules. The first one is, we do not treat individual numbers. Individual numbers are fairly meaningless. What we need to know is the trend. So if they're always 58, 55, 56, 55, 58, it's not a problem. If they were 80, 72, 68, 60, 50, 54, 53, is that a problem? Yes. So what's the trend? Is it always that way, or is it going downwards? So first of all, trend. So you can't just look at a single number in isolation. You need to look at the overall trend. The second is that we don't treat numbers. What do we treat? Patients. So just because that number is low doesn't mean we should automatically treat it, even if it is going low. We also need to look at symptoms. So what sort of symptoms might occur with a patient who's got low heart rate? Dizziness, tired, fatigue, fainting. What's the fancy word for faint? Syncope. So, if you have a patient who's got low heart rate, it's always their heart rate and they have no symptoms, do they need to have their heart rate treated? No. So, when we say we can use it to raise heart rate, it's only in the case of pre-anesthesia and symptomatic bradycardia. And it's usually a temporary measure. Because what's the ultimate treatment for symptomatic bradycardia? It's a pacemaker. The other thing you should also do is see if the patient's on drugs that lower the patient's heart rate. Because sometimes you can just take them off the drug, problem solved. So atropine is going to be used for symptomatic bradycardia and to raise heart rate with pre-anesthesia, sometimes. And it's also used to dilate eyes. Okay, the next drug on our list is called ipratropium. And the brand name is Atrovent. Ipratropium. Now, if you get it, atropine ventilation style, Atrovent. So basically, ipratropium is atropine that has been modified so it works better in your lungs. And ipratropium is administered by inhalation. So it's an inhaler or in a nebulizer. The patient breathes it in, it gets absorbed into the lungs, and it works primarily in the airway. When I say lungs, I mean airway, so bronchi. So it's going to cause bronchodilation and decreased secretion. And what's that going to treat? What kind of medical problems? What are the two big ones? Asthma and COPD. What the heck is COPD? It's chronic bronchitis and emphysema together. So really chronic bronchitis. When it comes to relaxing the GI tract, the drug there is called dicyclomine. Dicyclomine. Doing not doing that right. Dicyclomine. And the brand name is Bentyl. And it's used for irritable bowel syndrome when the patient has a lot of cramping. And then the last two drugs are used to prevent micturition for their treating incontinence. And those are tolterodine, which is Detrol, and then oxybutynin. So both of those two drugs are used to treat incontinence. Now, anticholinergic drugs are what are called Beers criteria drugs. And Beers criteria is named after Dr. Beers, who came up with this idea that we should really make a list of drugs that can be dangerous for old people, and then try not to give them to old people unless it's really necessary. So anticholinergic drugs are on that Beers criteria for a particular reason, and it's mental issues. So acetylcholine, as we're talking about it, is a peripheral nervous transmitter. But it also works in the brain. And it's responsible for making new memories, among other things. So patients who have Alzheimer's disease, which destroys acetylcholine neurons, are going to have less acetylcholine than usual. When you block acetylcholine in the brain, you can actually cause Alzheimer's dementia symptoms. So one of the things that happens is, you know, say you have a little old lady who's got incontinence, and so you give her some oxybutynin to treat her incontinence. And the next thing you know, she's Alzheimer's dementia. Well, chances are that's not really Alzheimer's, it's just an adverse effect of the drug. So anytime you have an elderly person with Alzheimer's or dementia symptoms, the first thing you have to do is look at their drugs and see if they're on anticholinergic drugs. If they are, you should probably take that off before you start treating them for Alzheimer's disease. Does that make sense? Now, what's a mnemonic? It's a memory device or trick. So there's a mnemonic that you can use to help remember anticholinergic effects. And it goes like this. Mad as a hatter, because of the dementia. Dry as a bone, because of the drying effects in the eyes and the skin and the mouth and the nose. And they're also not peeing as much. So dry as a bone. If you can't sweat, what is the purpose of sweat? Cool you down to become hot as a hair. And then because you can't sweat, you vasodilate to try and radiate heat, so the patient becomes red as a beet. So, mad as a hatter, hot as a hair, sorry, dry as a bone, hot as a hair, red as a beet, and then the last one is blind as a bat, because they can't see very well because of mydriasis. Now, if you have a patient who's got mydriasis, what do you think you should do as a nurse? What is mydriasis? Dilation of the eyes. So, if you've had your own eyes dilated, what do you think is important? Yeah. Dim the lights, maybe provide some sunglasses, and make sure that there is not anything that can harm the patient if they don't see it that well. If you have a patient who's got decreased sweating from anticholinergic effects, what sort of nursing diagnosis or nursing intervention do you think might be appropriate? keep the room cooler. If they've got heavy blankets on, you might need to take some blankets off. Sponge them. Now, what would a sponge bath? What would a sponge bath do? With cool water. Yeah, it'd cool them down and kind of act like sweat for them. If you have a patient who's got urinary retention, what should you do for them? Encourage them to go to the bathroom. Assess the last time they went. And if they need to, you might need to give them a catheterization. So you insert a tube up there and pull the urine out the old-fashioned... sorry, it's not old-fashioned. But you get the idea. If you have a patient who could have constipation from an anticholinergic effect, what could you do? Okay, so more fiber, more water. Make sure that they're adequately exercising, and you may need to ask the physician to order a laxative. So it's not just knowing what they are, but it's what would you do about them. And you need to be educating patients as well. And in the case of elderly folks, sometimes you need to educate the family. If you notice behavior changes, if you notice your mom's not quite the same after she starts this drug so that she doesn't pee her pants as much, you're not going to use that with your patient. So she's not as incontinent, then you need to call us immediately because that's an adverse effect of the drug that we can do something about. Does that make sense? Okay. So for the anticholinergic drugs, there are five of them you need to know. We just talked about the five drugs. We talked about what each of them does. You know all of the adverse effects that could potentially happen. The last thing is, what would you do if a patient has anticholinergic toxicity? Well, you'd give them a drug that increases acetylcholine activity. And that's the subject of our next drug class. Did you have a question, Maddie? Okay. All right. So our next drug class we're going to talk about ever so briefly is called, it's called cholinesterase inhibitors. Now, what is acetylcholinesterase? It's the enzyme that breaks down acetylcholine. So if we inhibit acetylcholinesterase, what are we going to end up with more of? More acetylcholine. So cholinesterase inhibitors increase the amount of acetylcholine. And they're used pretty much exclusively for two things. One is an antidote to too much anticholinergic. The drug for that is called physostigmine. It's very short acting, about 15 minutes, but it can penetrate into the blood-brain barrier, and it can snap your patient out of their dementia when they've got mad as a hatter. The other use for cholinesterase inhibitors is in a disease called myasthenia gravis. So myasthenia gravis is an autoimmune disease where you're destroying nicotinic M receptors. Now, what does a nicotinic M receptor do? What do nicotinic M receptors do? They stimulate skeletal muscles to contract. So if you're destroying those receptors, what's happening to the ability of that muscle to contract? It's decreasing. You're essentially denervating that muscle. Now, this, because it's an autoimmune disease, your immune system is attacking the receptors, it's going to be more common in young women. So most, for whatever reason, women have a tendency to have better immune systems than men, so they have fewer infections. But the downside is sometimes a little too good and attacks their own body. Autoimmune diseases have a tendency to manifest in early adulthood. So you're usually talking women, mid-20s to early 40s. Sometimes it can happen even earlier in a woman's teens, but usually that 20 to 40 range is where it tends to occur. Now, knowing that it occurs more often than women and that it affects their ability to use their muscles, how do you think a woman might know that she's got this problem? Or not know that she's got the problem, but know she has a problem and goes to get help for it. What do women do that requires a large amount of strength and endurance in their upper body? What? That they do more often than that. Doing their hair. When you do your hair, you got to keep your arms up above your head, holding a weight for a long period of time, right? Yes. Now, some of you have shorter hair and you don't know what I'm talking about, but, you know. So, sometimes what they find is they don't have enough ability to do that anymore, so they go to the doctor and then, through a series of tests, finds out they have myasthenia gravis. Now, in order to treat myasthenia gravis, there's a two-prong approach. One is we want to stop the immune destruction. How do we do that? Immunosuppressants. So if the damage is being done by the immune system, you suppress the immune system. We're going to talk about immunosuppressants for test three. So you don't need to know those for now. You just need to know that, generally speaking, that's what you do. Then you're going to address the symptoms with nervous drugs that increase the force of contractility. Now, how many of you have ever, talked to someone who couldn't hear very well? What do? You talk louder, right? You turn up the volume. So that's basically what we're going to do. What is the command to a muscle to contract? Acetylcholine. Now, because there's fewer receptors to receive the message, what are we going to do? We're going to turn up the volume of the acetylcholine. So how do we get more acetylcholine to be around? What is it that destroys acetylcholine? Cholinesterase. So how do we get there to be more acetylcholine? We inhibit cholinesterase. Does that make sense? So cholinesterase inhibitors are used to treat myasthenia gravis. Now, your book says that neostigmine is a drug that would be used, but that's an older drug that's no longer used very commonly. The drug that's more commonly used is called pyridostigmine. Now, what's the problem with a drug like pyridostigmine? It increases acetylcholine at your neuromuscular junctions, which helps the patient to be stronger. Fantastic. But what else? Where else does it increase the amount of acetylcholine? At your ganglia and at the muscarinic receptors. So your patients, as they get increased stimulation of acetylcholine, can get too much constriction. They can get meiosis. They can have too much secretions, hyperhidrosis. They can be sweating all the time. They can have too much sputum. They can have trouble breathing from bronchoconstriction. They can have bradycardia. They can have GI cramping, diarrhea, and they can have incontinence. It's kind of rough, right? So when you overdose a patient on pyridostigmine, you could end up with these things as adverse effects. Now, when a person is overdosed on pyridostigmine, they also get weak. So it's kind of one of those just right things. So you want the dose to be, if you don't give enough, they're weak. If you give just the right amount, they're strong. And if you give too much, they get weak again. Does that make sense? So we want them to be right in here in this optimal dosing range. Now, sometimes if a patient is weak, it's not clear, are they undertreated or overtreated? So if they have all those symptoms, you think they're overtreated or undertreated? They're overtreated, so they should lower the dose. If they're missing those symptoms, you still might not know if they're undertreated or overtreated. So there's an extremely short-acting cholinesterase inhibitor that they inject IV. It lasts for 3 or 4 minutes. And if their symptoms get worse when you inject that in there, you know they're overtreated. And if their symptoms get better for 2 or 3 minutes when you inject that, then you know they're undertreated, you raise the dose. Does that make sense? You don't need to know the name of that other drug. All right. Any questions about myasthenia gravis? It's a pretty small little disease. Small treatment. No questions? All right. So now we're going to move on. And we're going to talk about neuromuscular blockers. Now, if we have a drug that blocks muscarinic receptors, if it blocks nicotinic M receptors, neuromuscular junctions, what do you think that drug is going to do? We block acetylcholine from activating muscle. What's going to happen to the muscle? It won't contract. And what do we call a muscle that can't contract? Paralyzed. So, these drugs are sometimes called paralytics. Now, what are some purposes for paralytics? Torture. Okay, so you can use it for surgeries. So you paralyze the patient for surgery. You can paralyze the patient so they can be intubated. What does it mean to be intubated? So you put the tube into their trachea, and then they inflate a little cuff around it, and the person's breathing through that tube. You often do that for surgery or for a patient who needs to be ventilated. What do you think when you try and shove a tube down someone's throat? What do you think happens? Their body says, no! So to prevent all that, you paralyze the patient. Another use of paralytics is for what's called electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT. So sometimes when a patient has a depression or another psychiatric illness, one of the possible treatments is to shock their brain. Now, if you just shock a person's brain and you cause electrical impulses all over the brain, what do you think happens to the person's body? Muscle spasms everywhere. And patients would have incredible muscle spasms. Sometimes they would break bones. They might bite their teeth, break their teeth. It was pretty horrific back in the 60s and 70s. So we still do that to patients, but what we do now is we paralyze them first. And if you do it right, the brain kind of gets like reset, like you're rebooting the brain a little bit, but it doesn't affect all of their muscles. So it's much more humane, and there are some patients who are like, this is the best thing ever, it's so much better than all the other treatments I've tried. And so they do that as a potential treatment. So you can use the paralytics before you do electroconvulsive therapy. Now, when you paralyze a patient, are you stopping them from feeling pain? No. So, when you're using these for surgery, in addition to the paralyzing, what else do we need to do? We need to give some sort of anesthetic, and ideally we probably also would give something that is a sedative, something that makes the patient go to sleep. So, in the case of intubation, what they often use is a drug called etomidate. Not going to be on your test, so you can forget I ever said it until you're in complex care. But etomidate would be used to sedate the patient for intubation. Now, there's like 10 or 12 different drugs. You only need to know one for this class, and that's called succinylcholine. So you want to write that on the board? It's in the new notes that you don't have yet, but you will soon. So, succinylcholine. It is the number one drug that is, or number one neuromuscular blocker that is used in adult patients. It is not used in children, and the reason why it's so popular is it's extremely reliable, it's very predictable, and it's very short acting. You're able to bring a patient back out of it really easily. But, as a downside, the main problem is there's a very small group of people who have an allergic reaction to it that results in something called malignant hyperthermia. So the patient's temperature is going to start rising dramatically. And that can lead to sudden death. The treatment for it is a drug called dantrolene. Like Dan, T-R-O-L-E-N-E. Dantrolene. So what you need to know about succinylcholine is the most common, adults only. Malignant hyperthermia is a potential adverse effect. The treatment for that is dantrolene. That's all you need to know for succinylcholine specifically. You need to know the rest of it is just for paralytics in general. Any questions about neuromuscular blockers or paralytic or succinylcholine? I don't know the other name for succinylcholine. It's been around for a while, so pretty much everyone calls it succinylcholine. They are not used for tremors because it would make the patient paralyzed. So, Yeah. For the most part, yes. We'll talk about tremors next year when we talk about Parkinson's syndrome. All right, so at this point in the program, we're going to be moving from the parasympathetic drugs to sympathetic drugs. So, in this case, we're going to have to draw our little alien again. Only this time, he needs to be making a muscle also. Or she, as the case may be. All right, so our little alien head. Yeah, it's got a thick neck today. Making a muscle. The most disproportionate alien you've ever seen. All right. So we're going to give him some eyes and give him a nose. And anyway, we'll figure that out. So the first, now we've got three different receptors that we have to cover, not just one like we did with muscarinic. So in the case, this case, we're going to start with alpha 1. So alpha 1 is going to cause a couple things. It's actually pretty simple. It's really only in three places that we need to worry about. The first place is in your eyes. So alpha 1 in the eyes. When we stimulate alpha 1, we're going to end up with mydriasis or dilation. So sympathetic response results in increased light coming into the eye. Yeah. Before the advent of electricity, at night, most of the time, it was what color? Dark. And if you had to fight or flight in the middle of the night, what did you have to be able to do? See in the dark. So one of the major things that happens during sympathetic response is dilation of the eyes. Now, how many of you like to watch like emergency medicine type shows or drug, you know, medical shows in general? They shine a light in their eyes, and what do they say? Oh my goodness, their eyes are, their pupils are blown. What does that mean? Pupils are blown. They're as big as they can get. And that's a sign of really intense sympathetic response. That's a bad sign. So, depending on how big they get, that can be extremely bad. Now, knowing what you know about dilating the eye, what does it mean for a patient's vision? They can see better in dark, but it's hard to focus up close, which is why if you get nervous during a test, sometimes you feel like you can't focus and read the words on the page. You know what the solution to that is? At least one solution? Oh, yes, study. Another is go for a run right before your test. Yeah, sure, you'll come in kind of stinky, but you'll have used up all that stress. Now you can relax and sit down at the test and take it. Now, we also have alpha 1 receptors in the nose, in the skin. So I'll go in the skin and in the gut. That was supposed to be a stomach and intestines. And in all three of these places, it causes vasoconstriction. Now, if you have a balloon and you squeeze the balloon, what happens to the pressure inside the balloon? It goes up. If you were able to somehow stretch the balloon bigger, what would happen to the pressure inside the balloon? It would go down. So when you take a blood vessel and you constrict it, what happens to the pressure in that part of the arteries? The blood pressure increases. And what happens to the amount of blood that's able to go through there? It decreases. So there's going to be less blood going through the nose, skin, and gut. Now, when there's less blood going through your nose, it's easier to breathe in through your nose. There's less congestion, less swelling. When you get it in your skin, what happens to the skin in terms of color? Goes pale. In lighter folks, we call it pale or whiter. And in the case of darker skin folks, we call it ashen. It has kind of a grayish appearance. So that's caused by loss of blood flow through the skin. What do you think would happen if you touched their skin? It would be cool. And then the third thing that happens is we do that in the gut. So there's less blood flow going through your gut, and that leads to what kind of symptom with sympathetic response oftentimes? Not constipation. Nausea or butterflies in your stomach. So it depends on the intensity, but kind of like the less intense would just be butterflies. And it feels a little funny. And on the very severe side, you can actually have patients vomit as a result of that. So that range of symptoms can vary from, basically don't feel it, to, it feels a little funny, to patients so nauseated they vomit. Now, don't know. But, some people vomit with performance anxiety. Like you've ever seen the movie, it's not a very good movie, so I don't recommend watching it, but it's called Any Given Sunday. And it's one of Jamie Foxx's earlier movies. He plays this quarterback who's second string, and the main quarterback gets injured, so he gets his chance to play. And every time he goes on the field, he vomits on national television. So, yeah. I mean, it happens to some people. So, say again? Yeah, I've never actually seen that. I just know how it ends. I've seen the ending, so. But I've never seen the whole movie. Yeah. So if you diss yourself, the moral of the story is if you can diss yourself, then they can't diss you back. So, but anyway, there's one more place that we have alpha-1 receptors, and that is, here's the bladder, the urethra to the bladder. We've got constriction of the urethra. And we actually talked about this earlier when we talked about how it's difficult to go to the bathroom when someone's watching you. And the reason for that is you've got constriction of the urethra. So, when we stimulate alpha-1, we're going to get these things occurring. Now, what are some reasons why we might want to stimulate alpha-1? Medically speaking. Is there a reason why we might want less congestion in the nose? Or just a cold? Or allergies. Yeah, so cold and allergies are the big ones. And so drugs that do that, specifically that we use for that, would be phenylephrine and pseudoephedrine. We'll talk a little bit more about those in a few minutes. When it comes to vasoconstricting, if a patient's blood pressure is too low, can we raise their blood pressure by vasoconstricting? Sure. So we can do that as well. And this part isn't so much of an issue. But in dogs, when a dog has stress incontinence or what they call spay incontinence, so if you spay a dog, you basically take away its estrogen because it doesn't have ovaries anymore. This also happens in older women who go through menopause. When you don't have very much estrogen, eventually the tissue surrounding the urethra atrophies. And one of the reasons why elderly women tend to have more incontinence than younger women is because they don't have as much tissue kind of pushing in on the urethra. So in dogs, they actually use alpha-1 stimulators to cause this so the dog doesn't have pee everywhere in older female dogs or dogs who've been spayed. I'm not aware of its use in humans that way. But you could, I suppose. So those are the main reasons why you do it. If you have a patient who's bleeding and you cause vasoconstriction, could that stop the bleeding? Sure. So that's another reason why you might want to cause alpha-1 stimulation. Now, before we get too much farther, we've got to talk a little bit about some cardiovascular terminology. So the first thing is blood pressure. Actually, I've got slides for this, so I'm going to turn on the slide real quick like. Okay. So, brief sidebar. I'm going to turn this down. Video editors love it when you make them wait around, so. Okay. So, a brief sidebar. So before we can talk about what we use these drugs for, we just have to have a little bit of things out of the way. So the first one is blood pressure. The purpose of it is to push blood through the body. Hopefully you knew that, right? And what's the fancy schmancy term for pushing blood through an organ? Perfuse or perfusion. So the purpose of blood pressure is to perfuse organs, to push it through the body. Now, blood pressure is affected by your heart, how fast and how hard it's beating, by vasoconstriction, we talked about that, the tighter your arteries, the more blood pressure you have, the more dilated they are, the less blood pressure to have, and by the blood volume. The more blood volume you have, the higher your blood pressure, the lower your blood volume, the lower the blood pressure. Now, heart failure is when your heart is still beating, but it's not beating enough to beat your body's demand for cardiac output. Does that make sense? So, heart failure doesn't mean the heart is failing to beat at all. It's failing to beat enough. Failing to pump enough blood. So, heart failure, what's your patient? They're alive. Okay. Now, heart failure can be considered either acute or chronic. And we'll talk more about that later. Now, cardiac arrest, on the other hand, what does the word arrest mean? Stop. So when a policeman says, stop, you're under arrest. They're saying, stop, you're under stop. So cardiac arrest, the heart has stopped. And there's a technical word for that, and what is it? Dead. So in cardiac arrest, your patient is dead. Dead. Okay, now, there's dead and then there's dead. So, cardiac arrest is not necessarily permanent, and there's multiple forms of that. We'll talk about that later in Pathophorm 2. But the important thing to know is that sometimes you can perform a medical miracle and bring the patient back to life. So, when we say cardiac arrest, and we use a drug for that, it means the patient's heart is stopped. Bring them back from the dead. When we say heart failure, the heart is still pumping, the patient is still alive, we just need to make it work better. Does that make sense? Yeah. Now, we also need to talk about shock. So shock is when your blood pressure is so low that you have a hard time pushing blood through the body. You're having a hard time perfusing your organs. And there's 5 subtypes of shock. So the first one is called hypovolemic, which means that you don't have enough blood volume. What are some reasons why you might not have enough blood volume? Trauma causing what? Bleeding. So what's a fancy word for bleeding? Hemorrhage. So hemorrhage is one possible cause of hypovolemic shock. What's another one? You just don't drink enough. That's typically called dehydration. Another one could be that you're losing too much sweat. Another one could be that you are urinating too much. So diuretic. So there's a couple different possible causes of hypovolemic shock. What do you think the treatment is? You're never going to guess this one. Give fluids. Oh, give fluids, yeah. So not enough blood in the, not enough volume in the blood. What do you do? Give fluids. Increase the volume. Next one is cardiogenic shock, which is loss of cardiac output. Now, remember we talked about the difference between acute and chronic heart failure? Acute heart failure is technically cardiogenic shock. So the patient's heart is suddenly not producing enough blood output, and if you don't reverse that, your patient's going to die quickly. Neurogenic shock occurs when your blood vessels all go, remember I said that ordinarily they're 50%? Why are they 50%? They're 50% constricted because they're getting what? Sympathetic tone. So if they lose sympathetic tone, that's they lose the nervous tone, what's going to happen? They pop all the way open, and that causes a vast, you know, a big reduction in blood pressure. So what do you think the treatment for that is? We want to vasoconstrict them. And then we have anaphylactic shock, which is caused by an allergic reaction that results in a lot of airway edema. So basically chokes the patient to death because they can't breathe. And then we have septic shock, which is caused by an infection. So what do you think the treatment for that is? A bacterial infection, to be exact. Antibiotics, right! You know, some of you guys are like, I think it's antibiotics. Well, yes, it is antibiotics. Okay, so that is most of our brief sidebar, but I believe we have one final one, and that is compensation. What does it mean to compensate, physiologically speaking? Okay, so you're making up for a loss. So let's say that your patient is bleeding. They're losing blood volume. Can your body compensate to maintain blood pressure? So, by increasing heart rate and increasing contractility and increasing vasoconstriction, you can maintain blood pressure, ... for a while. So what happens is as their blood volume goes down, they squeeze more and they beat harder and to try and maintain, and it's going down like this just a little bit, and then what happens, they get to a point, all of a sudden they can't compensate anymore, and they drop suddenly. So that's graphically called in the business, your patient is crashing. Yeah. Or sometimes it's like they fell off a cliff. They were doing okay and then boom, they dropped suddenly. So that's caused by acute or sudden decompensation. That decompensation is when those compensatory mechanisms are no longer adequate and they fail suddenly. Does that make sense? Okay, so that acute versus chronic heart failure is sometimes the difference of they were chronic, compensating, bam, decompensated. Does that make sense? Okay, so understanding these terms is going to help to understand what we use these alpha 1 and beta 1 drugs for. So, back to our story. So now that we've talked about that little sidebar, let's talk about some of the reasons and drugs that can actually stimulate alpha-1. So, the first thing is we have two different major classes of alpha-1 stimulants. So we call those either catecholamine, or non-catecholamines. So, catecholamines, what do you think they have in them? An amino group. What's an amino group? Dr. Heyman, I was told by the juniors that, like, I didn't have to know any chemistry, and, like, I'll never use that again. Well, let me tell you something. The juniors lie to you. True story. So, you got to use your chemistry all the time. If you've forgotten all your chemistry, go back and review it. So, it has an amino group in it, which is? NH2. Right. So, catecholamines are amines, and your epinephrine, and your norepinephrine, and your dopamine are all catecholamines. And those are the natural ones in your body. And then we have some others that we're going to add in. The main one being dobutamine. There's some others that I recently took out because they're no longer really used that often, and there's no point in cluttering up your brains with them. You can thank me later. So, the catecholamines all have a few things in common. The first one is that they cannot be absorbed orally. Well, they can be absorbed, but they're broken down very, very quickly by enzymes in your gut and in your liver, so they never actually reach your systemic circulation. So for all practical purposes, you cannot give them effectively by mouth. Well, that means how do you have to give catecholamines? Injection. They're colorless solutions, and if they begin to oxidate, they'll turn brown. So don't give brown solutions to your patients. There's like some exceptions, but don't give them to patients. If it's brown, throw it out. And then the last thing is they also last very, very short time. So, for example, epinephrine will last in the body, for about 3 to 5 minutes, and then it's gone. So catecholamines, if you're going to be used for an extended period of time, it's not something that you give IV once and then it's done. It's something that the patient has to be on continuously. So they call that either a continuous infusion or a drip. So you heard them talk about the patient's on a drip or a cardiac drip, and that is a catecholamine that's going in over a long period of time. Sometimes there's other drugs you use as well, but that's what they mean. So it's going in over a long period of time. So, if you remember way back to that little diagram that we had, a little chart showing dopamine, epinephrine, and norepinephrine. Dopamine, epinephrine, and norepinephrine all stimulate alpha-1. So all of them can be used to vasoconstrict. But you're not going to use them all equally. So, norepi and dopamine are both used to maintain blood pressure in shock or decompensated heart failure. So dopamine and norepinephrine can be used to maintain blood pressure in a patient with shock or decompensated heart failure. Now, the problem with them is that they cause so much vasoconstriction that they might cause necrosis of tissue. Which tissues are most likely to be necrosed, do you think? Extremities, fingers and nose, toes, your gut, which would cause ulcers, and your kidneys, which would cause acute kidney failure. So those are the big dangers. These are drugs that you're only going to use in the ICU to keep a patient alive who's like on death's door. Dopamine has a nickname, nohopamine, and norepinephrine has a nickname. Its brand name is Levofed, and the nickname is Leave 'em Dead. Now, those nicknames were earned earlier when we didn't really understand how to use them as well. So we were waiting too long to use them. And so when you've got a patient who's almost dead, and as a last resort, now you put them on it, most of the time it's not going to work. It's not enough. So now we use them much more aggressively, sooner and often, and patients have a much higher chance of coming out the other side alive. So even though those nicknames are around, they're not quite as appropriate as they used to be. Now, epinephrine is a little bit more complicated. When it comes to alpha-1 stimulation, epinephrine is used primarily for three things. The first one is, if we mix it with some lidocaine, some local anesthetic, we can use it to reduce the amount of bleeding that a patient experiences. So if you're doing surgery on a patient, it can be useful for that because they don't bleed as much. You also don't need to use quite as much anesthetic, and the anesthetic will last longer. Now, what's the problem with using epinephrine in your anesthetic? Increased risk of well, they are. Increased risk of necrosis from too much constriction. So there's a general rule of thumb, which is you should avoid using epinephrine on surgeries of the fingers, nose, penis, and toes. It's like I'm a little poet. Now, it doesn't mean you can't use it, but you need to be more cautious when using it in those places. So the first one is anesthetics. The next one is anaphylactic shock. How many have ever seen the movie Hitch? If you haven't seen it, you should. It's a very funny movie. But one of the scenes in the movie, Hitch goes on a date and he eats some shrimp. And turns out he's allergic to shrimp. And his face blows up, swollen. And he's having a hard time breathing. He's like, Now, in real life, well, what they do in the movie is they go to a pharmacy and he drinks some Benadryl. But in real life, you should go to the emergency room, because if you're that far where you're having a hard time breathing, you know, you could die suddenly. So the treatment for that is epinephrine. And what's the delivery mechanism of epinephrine in that case? You're stabbing your leg in the gesture of an EpiPen. How many of you remember when EpiPens went up to like $400 a pop? Yeah, and those greed companies, I can't believe those drug companies are doing that to us. You know who the real problem was? The FDA. Because epinephrine it's not under patent anymore. Anyone can make epinephrine. But you see, it's really complicated to get the little needle into the leg and then give them the right amount. And there were approximately 6 different companies that had asked, can we have our like other version of EpiPen? And the FDA said, no, we don't like your version. There was one company that said, well, what if we just do like pre-filled syringes and the patient can just pop the top off and stab themselves? No, that's too complicated. Can't do it. So it turns out that the reason the price was so high is because the FDA was preventing competition, almost like they were business partners with the company that made it. Oh, here's another thing. If the physician writes a prescription for a brand name drug for you and there's a generic available, you know what the pharmacists will do? They'll automatically just substitute the generic. And they might say, would you like to pay extra for the brand name? But they're going to give you the generic most likely. But because epinephrine wasn't the drug that was being sold, it was the device that was being sold, there was actually one competitor called Adrenaclick. That was like less than half the price of EpiPen. But the FDA rules said that not only do you not ask to substitute, you're not even allowed to tell them there's an option. Go FDA. Anyway, EpiPen. So, for anaphylactic shock, you want to give subcutaneous epinephrine. That will cause vasoconstriction, which in turn will help to reduce the amount of swelling in the throat, thereby saving the patient's life. Now, what other movie did a person have anaphylaxis and die? I'll give you a hint. The actor's name was Macaulay Culkin. My Girl. I think it also happened in Bridge to Terabithia. I can't remember how the kid died in that one. Oh, she slipped and fall. Yeah. That movie is such it's like such a bait and switch. You think it's this lighthearted adventure, imagination, kid dies. The only thing that's worse is where the red fern grows. Because then it's dogs that die. Yeah. You know, you're like in third grade and they like start reading the book to you about the kid who saves up and earns his dogs and he treats, you know, trains them up and they go coon hunting and he's like, the dog saves his life from a mountain lion and then dies. And then the other dog dies too. And you're like 8 years old and you can't handle it. What?
Have you seen Old
Oh, yeah, they shoot the dog at the end. Have you ever seen Friends?
Yes.
You know, Phoebe's never seen the end of any of those movies where the dog dies. Oh, the other, it's such a good movie. So anyway, back to our story. Anaphylactic shock is life-threatening, and the treatment for it is epinephrine subcutaneous, and the brand name EpiPen is most synonymous with that. Next, we have something called status asthmaticus. Now, this is a little bit of a combination of beta 2 receptors and alpha 1 receptors, but heck, I'm going to mention it here. It's the same treatment. So, when a patient has an asthma attack, if they receive treatment and it doesn't get better within 20 minutes, the patient is at very high risk of sudden death. So to prevent that sudden death, you would give the patient epinephrine subcutaneously, and it does a combination of alpha-1 and beta-2 stimulation, which result, hopefully, in the resolution of the patient's asthma attack. So you can use it to treat status asthmaticus. Any questions about that?
It's also, subcutaneous.
Yeah. That is also subcutaneous. And then there's one more use for epinephrine, so I might as well just talk about it right now. And that is because it stimulates beta-1, it can stop a patient's cardiac arrested heart. So it can perform a miracle and bring a patient back to life. So you use it in cardiac arrest. Now, what's the most essential thing a person whose heart is stopped should receive? What is the most essential thing that a person whose heart has stopped should receive? How many of you had CPR training? What is the best chance of saving that patient's life? No, it is not chest compressions. No, it is not oxygen. No, it is not epinephrine. Electric shock, defibrillate. Okay. So, defibrillate is the number one. If that doesn't work, then you do chest compressions. That's basic CPR, basic life support. Once you give epi, you are no longer in the realm of basic. You are now moving into advanced cardiac life support. So when you give epi, you're doing ACLS. All right, so that's pretty much it for epi. Any questions about those items? By the way, talking about the shock, we're going to revisit shock throughout this semester. We're going to revisit again throughout next semester as we talk about various diseases. Then when you get to med-surg, you can talk about shock again. And then when you get to critical care, you're going to get us talk about shock yet again. And you know what you guys are going to pretend at each moment? We've never learned that before. Ain't never learned that. I don't even know what shock is. Is that when you put your finger in a light socket? So what's the definition of shock? Blood pressure is so low that perfusion is compromised. Blood pressure is so low you can't push blood through the body. Okay. What are your five types of shock? Low blood volume, hypovolemic, heart fails to pump enough, cardiogenic, loss of sympathetic tone in the blood vessels, neurogenic, allergic reaction, anaphylactic, and bacterial infection, septic. Learn it, live it, love it. All right, so that's it for alpha-1 stimulation. So now let's talk about because we forgot about the non-catecholamines. So now we're going to talk about phenylephrine and pseudoephedrine. So these are drugs that are not catecholamines, which means that you can give them in what manner? Orally. So you can give these by mouth. And the major use for both of these drugs is as a decongestant. Now, phenylephrine is an older drug and it's not as good, but it's the drug that everyone gets nowadays. Want to know why? No. How many of you ever seen a little pop phenomenon called Breaking Bad? That show is not appropriate for a Christian school. I don't know what you guys are doing watching that show. Shame on you for watching it. Now, what happens in Breaking Bad? Meth lab. Now, what do they use as as the ingredient, the major ingredient for meth in the first two seasons. Pseudoephedrine. Now, because the federal government thinks that all of you are meth heads or meth cooks, you're all Breaking Bad, you are not allowed to have free access to pseudoephedrine. So to get it, you have to go to the pharmacy and you have to ask for it. They scan your driver's license, and if you try and get too much pseudoephedrine on a regular basis, you'll be arrested. You can only get one package per day, and you can get no more than, I think it's like 9 grams of it within a month's time. If you try and get more than that, you're suspected of being a meth cook, or what they call a mule. So in this case, what happens at the beginning of the third season is that their mules have all gotten too much pseudoephedrine, and they can't buy anymore and sell to them to make meth, so now they have to find another source of making meth. And the rest of the season is about that. The rest of the show is about that. So you can't get it unless you do that, because the federal government and the state of Florida thinks that you're all a bunch of meth cooks. But pseudoephedrine is more effective and has fewer side effects than phenylephrine. So if you've ever seen a cold medicine that ends with a D, so Mucinex D, or an antihistamine that ends with D, Claritin D, Allegra D, Zyrtec D, all of the D's stands for decongestant. And what is the decongestant? It's phenylephrine. Now, 15 years ago, it was pseudoephedrine. But 15 years ago, you guys weren't yet meth cooks. Because it causes alpha-1 stimulation, it's going to cause vasoconstriction. When it vasoconstricts your nose, it reduces congestion. Congestion, by the way, is mainly swelling of the nose caused by excess blood flow. It's not snot. So when you take pseudoephed, it might make it so that you don't have as much swelling, but it might not necessarily reduce the amount of mucus that you're having. So sometimes it gets easier to breathe, but now you got just not just dripping out your nose. Yeah, you gotta just take another drug to fix that. Outside the scope of test one. Because it can cause vasoconstriction, it can raise a person's blood pressure. And it can also make a person feel nervous or prevent them from sleeping. In fact, how is pseudoephedrine marketed? Or phenylephrine? Non-drowsy. In fact, it might prevent you from sleeping. Because it can cause increased blood pressure, what kind of person might not want to take it? Say again? Type A. Okay, a very nervous person. What else? A person who already has high blood pressure, and the fancy name for high blood pressure is hypertension. So, hypertension patients, it's not that they can't take it, but they need to be cautious when they take it. Use smaller doses, monitor their blood pressure. If the blood pressure goes up, they need to stop taking it, call the doctor. Does that make sense? Okay. So it's not a contraindication, which means they can't take it. It's a precaution. All right. So that's pretty much it for that. Now we can talk about blocking alpha-1 over on this side. I can't believe people just use these up and then just leave them here. Hold on. Oh. All right, so when we block alpha-1, we're going to get the opposite of everything that happened when we stimulated alpha-1. So in the eyes, what are we going to get? You're going to get meiosis. And the skin and gut, what are we going to get? We're going to get vasodilation. And in the urethra, we're going to get relaxation or dilation there. And in the nose, we're going to get increased congestion. And that makes sense. It's basically just the opposite of all of the effects of stimulating. So, we don't have a therapeutic use for meiosis. So, that's just an adverse effect. We don't really have a use for congestion. That's just an adverse effect. Vasodilation. This can be an adverse effect or it can be a therapeutic effect. If you have a patient who had surgery and they got lidocaine with epi and they started to have necrosis of the tissue, what is necrosis, by the way? Tissue death. So if their tissues are beginning to die, turn black and die, we can prevent that from happening by giving an alpha blocker. So in this case, vasodilation would be a therapeutic effect. Does that make sense? If you have a patient who's got high blood pressure and you want to vasodilate and lower their blood pressure, that would also be a therapeutic effect. Does that make sense? Okay. So this is one use for it. The major use in terms of vasodilation nowadays is for preventing necrosis or reversing necrosis. You can't reverse, but prevent it from getting worse. It used to be that we also use these drugs for high blood pressure, to lower a person's high blood pressure, but we don't really do that anymore. So if you see it on, they are still considered antihypertensives and could potentially be used for it, but in real life, you're not going to see that very often. Does that make sense? Blink twice. Okay, you're alive. So the drug that we use to prevent necrosis is called phentolamine. Phentolamine. So three major uses for phentolamine. The first one is when a patient's had too much epi. Second is if the patient has a cancer that produces epi. And that cancer's name is pheochromocytoma. So, it's P-H-E-O, pheo, and then chromocytoma. It's a tumor of the adrenal glands that secretes epinephrine. Think you can handle that? Pheochromocytoma. It's a tumor of the adrenal gland. What do the adrenal gland produce? Epinephrine. So when you have a tumor that's made out of adrenal tissue, what's that tumor probably going to do? Produce more epinephrine than usual. So that can make a person have toxicity. Use phentolamine to prevent that. And then the last thing that can happen, there's a disease called Raynaud's disease or Raynaud's phenomenon where a person gets vasoconstriction of the fingers. Now, when it's mild, they just have cold fingers. But when it's severe, it can actually cause tissue necrosis of the fingers and the toes. So to prevent that from occurring, you would use an alpha blocker. Now, those are all fairly limited use cases. Most of the time, when you see a patient on an alpha blocker, the reason for that is going to be the urethra. Every man has a curse wrapped around his urethra. It's called a prostate. As a man gets older, prostate gets bigger. But the prostate doesn't just grow outwards, it also grows inwards, which means that the urethra, which goes through the middle of it, gets squeezed over time. That makes it harder and harder for an older man to go to the bathroom. By the time a man is 50, he's got some degree of increased size of the prostate. The fancy name for that is benign prostatic hyperplasia. So benign because it's not cancer, not because it doesn't cause problems. Prostatic because it's of the prostate, and hyperplasia means excessive cell growth. So one of the ways you can treat BPH, benign prostatic hyperplasia, is by trying to shrink the size of the prostate. Another way you can do it is by cutting out part of the prostate. And a third way you can do it is by giving drugs that relax the urethra. So the major use for alpha-1 blockers, what you're going to see it most often used for, is in patients who have EPH that'll help them go to the bathroom more easily. You can also use it in kidney stones. Patients with kidney stones have ureteral spasms, and you can use it to kind of relax that and make it easier to pass the kidney stone. But the major use is is in BPH. Now, in terms of adverse effects, the major adverse effects that patients are going to experience who are on BPH medications is vasodilation, which can lead to something called orthostatic hypotension. Now, what the heck is orthostatic hypotension? All right, so to measure it, you take their blood pressure lying down, sitting up, and standing up. And what are you looking for? A difference in what? A drop in what? In which blood pressure to be specific? Which number? The top number or the bottom number? The top number, if it goes down by 10 millimeters or more, is considered to be orthostatic hypotension. Now, how many of you ever had this happen? You're lying down, lounging around, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, I gotta get up! And you get up real sudden, and you're like, woo! Dizzy, just for a second, and then you're okay. What happened? Why did that happen? Okay. So when you were lying down, the blood was distributed all throughout your body, and you stood up suddenly, and gravity pulled all the blood down to your legs. And your brain went, whoa! And then, nervous system kicks in, sympathetic response happens, and vasoconstriction all down your legs pushes blood back up into your brain. Okay, I'm cool. And that took like 2 seconds to happen, right? In orthostatic hypotension, that basic process is happening slower. So when a person stands up, they haven't fully accommodated yet, and there's still too much blood down in their legs and not enough blood up in their head. And so as a result of that, they can become lightheaded and fall. So the big problem with orthostatic hypotension is the potential for falls. So patients who have BPH, who are being treated with alpha blockers, are at increased risk of falling because of orthostatic hypotension. Now, to help, what we typically tell patients to do is take their drug at night. Now, what's the problem with that? The idea is you'll have the drug will be strongest at night while you're asleep, and you won't be falling because you'll be asleep. It's a great theory, right? What's one of the problems with BPH, do you think? A person who can't quite empty their bladder all the way. They have to go to the bathroom more often, and they go to the bathroom at night. So you've got to tell them, when you wake up at night to go to the bathroom, you can't just get up and go. You have to get up and sit on the side of the bed and dangle your legs for like 5 minutes. Does that make sense? So what you might want to provide for the patient is a urinal, which is like a little plastic cup with a handle and a lid. They can just pee on the side of the bed and not even have to get up. Go right back to bed. Does that make sense? So we have to warn our patients that they could have orthostatic hypotension. What is that? Your blood pressure can go low when you stand up. So you need to stand up really slowly. When you go from lying to standing, sit on the edge of the bed for about 5 minutes and wait, then get up. If you have to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and you need to do that. If you can't wait to get to the bathroom, you might fall. So maybe you want to have a little urinal at your bedside. Does that make sense? What's the other big cause of, since we're just talking about orthostatic hypotension, what's the other big cause of orthostatic hypotension? It's just low blood volume in general. So patients who are a little bit dehydrated will also tend to have orthostatic hypotension. All right. The drug that is most commonly used for this is called Tamsulosin. And the brand name is Flomax. Get it? Your urine flowing to the max. Remember I told you that brand names are often suggestive of what they do? So, there's another one. This brand name is Rapaflow. You can't make this stuff up. So, other adverse effects that can also happen, increased congestion, they can have meiosis. And one other thing is that because it affects the urethra, when you cause relaxation of the urethra, it can actually inhibit a man's ability to have an orgasm or to ejaculate. So what happens sometimes when they're on an alpha-1 blocker is they can have an erection and they can have intercourse, but they can't quite get there. So they kind of become like a woman. Oh, that's bad. So, you know, women don't necessarily have orgasms every time they have sex, whereas men most of the time do. But as a man gets older, it gets harder to have the orgasm, and then when they're on one of these drugs, it makes it even harder. And one of the things that we have to be able to do as nurses, we need to have these conversations with patients. Because if you give this type of patient drug to a patient and they are not expecting that, they might not take the drug anymore. So you've got to be able to warn them that, just so you know, there's a chance that it might be more difficult to have an orgasm. And if you do, that's not your problem, that's not your broken, it's the drug is causing that. So if that happens, don't just stop taking the drug. Give us a call and let us know. Does that make sense? Okay. So, that is pretty much it for alpha blocking. Any questions about alpha blocking?
With the whole orgasm thing, is it specifically just for alpha-1 or is it just for the drug Flomax?
Say that again?
Is it specifically...
It sounded like you said double orgasm.
No.
Okay.
No.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. I meant like...
The inhibition of...
Alpha-1 in total.
It's alpha-1 inhibition in general.
Okay.
So any alpha-1 blocker could potentially cause that. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question about the... Well, it doesn't really apply to this, but you were talking about like the EpiPen. And so the drug itself isn't what they're really paying for. It's the device that they use for it.
Yeah, I mean, the epinephrine itself is so ridiculously cheap, it's like non-existent.
Just because, like, I take Enbrel, and it's an injection, and they use, like, an EpiPen type of... So I wasn't sure, because it's really expensive without insurance. So I wasn't sure if it was, like, the actual medication, or if it was now that you say that it's the device.
Well, it's the combination. See, it's the medical device you're paying for, but the medicine inside it, once it's off patent... is ridiculously cheap. I mean, epinephrine is pennies for like a pint of it. But it's how you deliver it. That's what you're really paying for. And the reason it's so expensive is because the FDA is suppressing, competition.
Okay.